In this episode, we speak with Felipe Capella, the co-founder and CEO of LoadSmart, which leverages cutting-edge technology and industry expertise to deliver optimized, reliable, and transparent freight services and solutions. LoadSmart was founded in 2014 and went on to gain capital backing from investors like Maersk, Ports America, TFI, CSX, BlackRock, and SoftBank. From day one, Felipe has been responsible for all product strategy and development. Previously, he was an attorney at Inter-American Development Bank in Washington, D.C., and before that, an associate with Sullivan & Cromwell in New York. I'm your host, RJ Lumba. We hope you enjoy the show. If you like the episode, click to follow.
RJ Lumba is the executive chairman of Market Insight Media and the managing partner of GrowthCap. He is the host of Great Entrepreneurs, a podcast for driven entrepreneurs and business owners. Our podcast covers all topics related to the entrepreneurial journey, from ideation to execution to optimization and to reaping the rewards of a well-run business. In the minutes ahead, we'll share with you unique insights and tactics from some of today's most accomplished and inspiring entrepreneurs.
Felipe, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It's a delight to be with you.
My pleasure.
So the first thing that crossed my mind as I was preparing for this interview was that you chose to enter a space that's maybe not well known by most people, freight management. How did the idea come about?
That's a good question. Actually, my background, believe it or not, is in law. So I started to practice law back in Brazil, stayed there for a few years, came to the U.S., practiced law across New York and Washington, D.C. So after 10 years of this kind of corporate experience, I wanted to do something new, right? To build something out of nothing. I always had that itch, if you will. So my partner, Ricardo, he was actually going through the same experience, but instead of law, he had like 13 years at Goldman Sachs. And he was going through the same, I don't know, mental experience, if you will. He wanted to build something new, so he left Goldman. People call him crazy, by the way, because he had a good position there. And we were very pragmatic, analyzing different industries, industries that lack technology, industries that were big enough, and industries that had like high fragmentation. And therefore, out of many options, we realized, you know, freight in the United States is something that, again, checks all the boxes and is kind of ready for disruption, if you will. So we decided, you know what, let's focus on that, dedicate ourselves to kind of bring technology into the freight industry. And that was 2014. So 10 years, and we're still here going strong.
That's remarkable. You know, it's easier said than done to go from a broad analysis of what's happening across industries to find the gap where technology is not really being leveraged, and then to go after it. Did someone have a background or a network in the freight industry?
Yeah, I think Ricardo, while at Goldman Sachs, he participated in some restructurings of certain companies like YRC, which was a quite large company back in the days. So again, as an analyst, I think he participated, and then he got introduced to the industry. But you're right, it was a big leap of faith, if you will. But I will tell you as well that we paid the price for that. We paid a certain price for not being kind of specialists in the industry, and we made our own mistakes as well, right? Sometimes you come with some naive assumptions about the industry, and you're forced to learn the tough realities by doing it. And again, we learned some hard lessons through the journey as well. So I would not say it was optimal, right? Jumping in an industry that we didn't know a lot about. But on the other hand, that allowed us to come with fresh new ideas from the outside world, if you will. And some of them, I think, were interesting for the industry.
Yeah, it seems that you were able to figure it out. I mean, now looking back over 10 years and seeing the partners that you were able to bring in, your capital partners with Maersk and, you know, BlackRock, SoftBank, and to build a great team around you, you were able to gradually figure out each of the problems that you came up against. I noticed that you graduated or you scored in the top 3% with the bar exam. So I guess, you know, one question is, it seems probably you and your partner have the intellectual rigor. How much did that play a role in being able to kind of be successful in this undertaking?
Well, I think looking back, right, again, 10 years in this journey, again, we faced and interacted with a lot of startups throughout this decade, right? And a lot of them didn't make it. When I look at them and I look at us and the things that we were trying to do back in the days and what we're doing right now, a lot of the startup success comes out of good timing, in all honesty, right? Either you're too late or you're too early, right? And ideally, you come with a solution that is kind of the right time for it, right? Because even when we started, we tried to introduce this instant pricing capability, which everyone takes for granted in the internet today, right? I can do everything and have a price immediately, right? I can book flights and rent cars, whatever, and have all instant pricing. But back in the days, in 2014, 15, you could not do that actually if you had to book a truck to move 40,000 pounds of widgets from LA to Chicago, right? That was not available for many reasons. But I was trying to introduce that to the industry, and we were a little bit too early, in all honesty. We tried to integrate with partners, and then we realized that a lot of the software in the industry was still on-premise. It was not in the cloud, right? So integrating our own solution with the incumbents, if you will, was not something that was doable in 2015, 2016. So being a bit too early, people talk a lot about the first comer advantages, but I don't think people talk enough about the pains as well. So to try to answer your question, if I had to rank what makes a company successful, I think timing would be kind of at the top three, if you will. Of course, together with the basic requirements, right? A good team and intellectual capabilities and all this type of stuff. But and of course, the product has to be good, it has to tackle an actual pain point, it has to add value. But I think timing is something that it's probably one of the most important ones, if not the most important.
We'll be curious to hear about the early days and how long it took before you came up with a product that someone was willing to pay for and what that product was.
Yeah, the early days, a lot of pain and suffering, blood, sweat, and tears, if you will. I think it took us around a year to come up with kind of the first prototype, if you will, right? And also because you have to realize that, again, coming from out of industry and having just a broad idea, again, it took us a year to kind of productize or to get to a point in which you were ready to build and offer something, right? I think, again, it depends on different entrepreneurs and different companies, right? Sometimes people have a specific idea that they feel very strong about. So day one is already like a very specific thing, right? And usually they have to change that as they go, right? They learn things. So sometimes it's just better to be honest with yourself and admitting that you don't know a lot of stuff and taking your time if you have the cash and the opportunity to do so in order to really have a specific product that is built with the actual experience of hearing other people in the industry and talking to customers, right? Instead of coming with a solution on day one. I'm very skeptical of people saying like, I know the solution, I'll start building that from day one. I've been doing this for 20 years and I've noticed that the industry lacks X, Y, and Z. Then you can have a higher certainty, right? But especially if you are, if you don't have this 20 years of experience, if you're on the younger side of the entrepreneurial journey, if you will, I think sometimes it's better to be honest with yourself, start very flexible, and take a bit of time to understand exactly what you should build.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure the product now is multi-layered. There's a lot of different features. Maybe for the benefit of our audience, if you can share maybe the most used feature, the one that maybe you lead with, and then maybe the other capacities or the other elements to the product.
Yeah, today, right, our company is divided into three main offerings. The first one is what we call freight brokerage. So we actually provide the services of moving freight for large, like Fortune 100 companies or smaller companies as well. They're moving 30,000, 40,000 pounds of widgets or produce from one place to the other in the United States, right? And again, the number one product that we launched in this specific segment is this instant pricing, instant booking capability, meaning that you can book a 53-foot-long trailer to pick up something, I don't know, in LA tomorrow morning and deliver a few days later in Jacksonville, Florida, something that you could not do a few years ago. The second segment is called managed transportation. So companies that decide to completely outsource their transportation department to us, right? Saying like, you know what, you guys have all the technology expertise into kind of procuring trucking capacity and moving freight across the US. So it's better if I just allow you guys to make the decisions on my behalf. And my core business is manufacturing widgets or as a, so it's not transportation, but transportation is ancillary. So we take care of that. That's the second one. And the third one is that we also now have a comprehensive software offering for the industry. We have a shipper management system we call Shipper Guide TMS that allows shippers to just manage their transportation using our software. We have the largest dock appointment solution in the industry, which controls when trucks, the right appointments to arrive at a warehouse, right? Otherwise, you have random trucks arriving maybe sometimes at the same time and having like a queue of trucks outside of the warehouse. So we control this kind of inbound solution. We're in more than 3,000 warehouses across the US. We have a yard management solution that leverages computer vision to track trucks and track trailers throughout your yard. So again, have a lot of software solutions for shippers, trucking companies, and warehouses. As you see, we kind of expanded the service offering throughout this many years.
Yeah, I was going to ask, as you were scaling the company, was it readily apparent which new area you should go into, or did it take a lot of deliberation? Should we do this? Should we stay focused on our original product and have one line of focus? How difficult was that, making those decisions?
That's interesting because internally, people always complain here that I have too many projects. And we used to say that companies that have too many priorities have none. So it's very difficult to balance the ideas of expanding service offerings and going into ancillary areas, if you will, with this obsessive focus about being the best at a specific thing. I think freight, again, it's very difficult to have one recipe for things. I think freight specifically is an area in which, as you add ancillary offerings, it complements the whole thing, right? Because if you're a shipper, if you're a big company and you ship 100 loads a day, I'm talking about like, not talking about parcel, like a box, I'm talking about 40,000 pounds of cargo. You really don't want to have 20 different providers all like taking care of a small part of your business, right? You really want to have companies that can actually take care of a broader mix of services or tackle larger pain points at the same time. So I think freight specifically benefits out of this increased number of ancillary services. But to answer your question, it was not easy internally, right? A lot of people were against us kind of expanding the business model and creating all their revenue streams. So at a certain point, we have to make a decision and go for it. And something that we say here is that we want to hear everyone that disagrees because we want to take everything into consideration. But once a decision is made, we say like we need to disagree and commit, right? Mm-hmm. So if we disagree on the decision, I'll set aside, I voiced out my disagreement that was taken into account when making a decision. But when someone makes a decision that we do not agree, we just disagree and commit, right? I have been part of that as well, right? Even though, again, I'm including theory, just override decisions. But a lot of times I'm not very close to the problem, right? So I may disagree. I may say like, hey, guys, I actually think we should go towards this other direction. But you guys know better because you're closer to the customer in this case. You're closer to the problem. If you disagree with me, I will disagree and commit and support you in your journey. So I think expanding business lines at a certain point was a bit like that, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm curious how your experience was with the company during the COVID period and the challenges you had to navigate during that time.
Yeah. And again, I think every company and every industry faced different challenges with COVID, but a lot of people that are not from the industry do not realize the craziness that went through in freight. Because remember, what happens is that with lockdowns, everyone stayed at home, right? So all the kind of services, if you will, barber shops, restaurants, they all shut down. So people had this extra cash that they used to commit to services. They just started to buy stuff online, right? So first we had this big dip in demand for, I don't know, a few weeks. Then people realized, you know, if I'm not spending on restaurants anymore, I'm going to buy this new pair of headphones, right? And or I'm going to buy this construction material because I'm going to expand my house or whatever, right? So we saw like this gigantic demand of freight. And you can imagine that the whole industry was not prepared to handle that. So prices went crazy, demand went like bananas, and there were kind of lack of trucks to move everything that people were buying, right? And that lasted for a couple of years. And then in 2022, when things started to settle down, we saw the shift back to normal, like people going back to services, right? Then extra capacity in the industry, too many trucks around. So the price collapsed. So for us in the past few years, it has been kind of a roller coaster of experiences going up and super excited and prices going up dramatically. And after that, 22 to 23, things collapsing, right? So it's been quite interesting to navigate these extremes, right? Of getting super excited, trying to hire a lot of new people, launching new things. And then you realize, well, prices now went down. We have to be a bit more conservative. We have to manage the company in a much more effective way. Right. So I've learned a lot through this journey.
You know, when you look at the overall market, this is a massive market. I think on your site, it says about 900 billion market size. When you look at the space you're playing in and your position in the space, you know, how much further do you have to run? How big of a company can LoadSmart become?
Yeah, if you take a look at, as you mentioned, the industry is really, really big, right? When you disregard other ancillary services like warehousing or distribution centers, transportation alone is $800-900 billion, right? So, and it's highly fragmented, right? You have, depending who you ask today, just the intermediaries, the freight brokers of the world, you have tens of thousands out there. So there is a huge opportunity in the next 10 to 20 years for consolidation of the industry. People have been talking about consolidation of the freight industry for a long time, but I think as companies adopt more technology and as the barriers to entry become a bit higher, because again, the level of sophistication demanded by shippers just increases with time, I think there's a natural consolidation of the industry. So, and we're already seeing that now. We see several multi-billion dollar companies that have been created in the past 5 to 6 years from scratch, from zero. Mm-hmm. So in this industry, so I think there's a big opportunity for a company to become much bigger than it is today. But mm-hmm. It's a journey, right? People usually like to believe that they watch the network, right, or other movies, or they read books, and like, oh, and then overnight this thing exploded. Let me tell you guys, it's never overnight. And when people say overnight, they're talking about 10 years. This is the overnight. Mm-hmm. Right. So this is a grind. It's especially in an industry with there's a bit more backwards, if you will, in terms of technology. You need to wait for the whole industry to progress. Right. You cannot change it by yourself, especially if it is a very large industry and especially if it is B2B. So it's a journey. It's never overnight.
I'd like to go back to something you said earlier about wanting to do something entrepreneurial. You went into law and you worked in law. I'm curious if you showed signs of being an entrepreneur even earlier in life before you decided to go to law school, before maybe even before you decided to go to college.
I think I could claim so. I tried different businesses when I was just out of law school. I actually started my own practice, right? In hindsight, I think it was a mistake. But if you're looking for signs, there you go, right? Again, if I could go back in time, I would rather have joined a large firm and learn with something that was already established out there. Mm-hmm. But again, if you're looking for signs of earlier entrepreneurship, I think that counts.
Okay. How about your investors? You know, it's a tough undertaking to go on the capital raising process and then to figure out who to partner with. Can you tell us a little bit about kind of the nature of your relationships with your investors and the value that they've helped provide to you?
Yeah, I think we have been quite lucky. I would say with the investors that we have. I think if you compare us with some of our peers, at least in the industry, that went through like a different route. And by that, I mean, they raised money out of California venture capital companies that are used to the invest in technology, right, and SaaS businesses. For our cap table, we looked for investors that had like a deeply understanding of logistics and transportation, right? So we have today Maersk, right, largest ocean carrier in the world. We have Ports America, largest port terminal operator. A third of the containers in and out of the U.S. pass through one of their terminals. We have CSX, second largest railroad in the U.S. We have a Home Depot, top five retailer in the U.S. and probably largest flatbed shipper in the United States. So these guys are like infrastructure, asset-heavy players that know a lot about logistics and transportation. So I think we benefited in two different ways. First, we never had that venture capital push of like a growth at all costs, right? Subsidize your customers, which was a lot of the West Coast venture capital vibe, right? It turned out to be a mistake, at least in our industry. And again, we got a lot of good feedback on things that we should or should not do, at least from an educational perspective. They never forced us in any direction, but we had always had access to very honest feedback about the products or services that we were offering. Mm-hmm. So that helped us a lot, but it was not easy as well, to your point. Raising capital from these players, they're not known for being super fast. They have their own business, right? Their business model is not investing. It's different. But again, at the end of the day, I think for us, it worked out really, really well.
A critical element for all businesses is the people that help drive the company forward. How would you describe your culture and what you look for when you're hiring folks?
Yeah, absolutely. Today, something that I always say to the newcomers, to new classes of employees, is that they have to understand that this concept of company, right? Because you have a lot of folks also joining the workforce, but young folks, they have these things in mind, like, I'm going to go there and work for this company, right? And that may be true if you're working for, I don't know, Google or Facebook or a company that has 10 or 100,000 people, but for a startup, even in growth mode, right, which is not like 10 and 20 people anymore, this concept of company is not really a reality, meaning that the concept is a legal concept. And when I tell people, it's like, there's no company, guys. If you think the company is going to help this issue that you guys found, or that issue, or if you guys think we're not doing something well, but the company has to fix it, let me tell you guys, the company does not exist. It's a fiction. The company, let me tell you guys something that is a surprise for you guys. The company doesn't exist. It's us. It's me, you guys, those folks out there, the HR folks. You know, so if you want to improve something, if you guys see something that is not working, you have to raise your hand and tell us or tell your colleagues that, hey, I found something that I don't think is the best way of doing things. And it could be something very small, like, hey, we have this weekly meeting that 20 of us jump on a call for an hour, and I think it's a waste of time for everyone. And maybe if you raise your hand and you raise that point, when people look at it, it's like, yeah, why are we having this meeting? Let's just cancel it. Well, guess what? You just got 20 hours a week, 1 hour for each of your colleagues. You did an amazing job just raising your hand, right, and pointed that out. So I think nowadays, when you talk about people, the first thing and the thing that we focus a lot is on people that speak up. They're willing to identify things they're not doing well and understand that no one else is coming to fix these things. It's on all of us. So trying to foster this sense of ownership and sense of curiosity as well, and asking, like, why do we have this? Why do we have this other thing? Why this process? Are you guys sure that this product will resonate, right? And not creating this culture of just saying either yes, sir, or just, oh, the company does that because there's probably a reason behind that, so let's not challenge it. No, the opposite. Maybe there was no reason behind it, and someone just set it up very fast, like 3 years ago, and that's just the way things are. So don't take anything for granted, and we like the people with this kind of spirit of challenging and asking why and raising their hands here.
Mm-hmm. What's the best insight you ever received from another entrepreneur?
the best insight? Well, what I would say, I'm highly skeptical about advices. So that would be my advice. I think you should listen to everyone and pay attention. Everyone knows something that you don't first. But also probably people are or could be wrong, even though they're the best and most well-known professional in your industry or in general, right? It could be Elon Musk. There's probably something that Elon Musk says or does that you disagree with. And you should be super honest with yourself. Listen to everyone that people say. And at the end of the day, judge for yourself. Because I also see a lot of people that they look at even like in industry specialists and they say like, well, this guy said X, Y, and Z, therefore I have to do X, Y, and Z. No, listen to the guy, digest it, and make your own decision. And at the end of the day, when you make your own decision, you're never going to regret it. Right. So again, on the advice angle, I'm one of the skeptical ones. And I rather people just listen to everyone and make their own decisions.
Well, that's excellent advice. Last two questions. One is, can you tell us about a person who has had a profound influence on you?
I don't know. This is a good question, but I'm not sure it's easy to nail that to one person. From the dead ones, I think, I don't know, Hayek, the economist, had a good influence on the way that I think today. Churchill is something that I thought was very interesting as well and shaped some things that I think today. Thomas Sowell is someone that I really like, which is he's alive. So yeah, from those ones, I like this guy. It says, I don't love to obsess about business books unless they are very research-driven. Mm-hmm. If it's just like lessons I learned, again, I'm a bit skeptical. And I actually think people learn more from other people's failures than their successes. Mm-hmm.
Last question. Can you tell us about a charity cause or other endeavor that you're passionate about?
I'm very passionate about education in general. I'm still finding ways that I can contribute in a very objective manner. But I think in general, education is something that I have unorthodox views. And I think people should question a bit more our current educational system, both like from primary education to college education. A lot of things have been built for industrial revolution. I don't think it is great to get young kids and sit them in classes and for 5 hours straight. I don't think that's how human beings flourish. I'm highly skeptical of college education. I usually think nowadays that if you put people through a work experience from 18 to 22, 9 times out of 10, you're going to be a better person if you go through this professional experience compared to a college for 4 years. So again, I'm trying to find ways to kind of foster that discussion and try to implement changes that I think will be positive for the future.
Well, Felipe, I want to thank you again for taking the time for this conversation. This has been wonderful.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.